All right, y'all, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. It's Chaos in Austin, live from Chaos Los Angeles Division. It's a pretty big conglomerate for a little pirate radio station. All right. I'm sure you guys know that one of my favorite blogs to read is that of Chris Floyd. It's called Empire Burlesque. That's also the name of one of his books, Empire Burlesque, High Crimes and Low Comedy in the Bush Imperium. And this blog, Empire Burlesque, is just absolutely fantastic. It's the best. It goes right on your list of RSS feeds or however you do it there. It's chris-floyd.com. Welcome back to the show, Chris. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Good to be here.
Well, first of all, I guess I wanted to say it's been so long since we've talked. I don't know if we've discussed Barack Obama at all, but I certainly like the way you've been covering his administration so far on your blog. Let's start with this. It's relevant. People will see the point here in just a moment. Why don't you tell me a little bit about Binyam Mohammed? Who is he, and why should anybody care about him, Chris?
Well, obviously nobody cares about him very much. He's a British resident. He was someone from Ethiopia originally. He fled persecution in Ethiopia, came to Britain, was given leave to stay while his asylum case was worked out. At some point, he was a Muslim. He went to Pakistan. He went to Pakistan to try to kick a drug habit. While he was in Pakistan, he somehow fell afoul of the Pakistani authorities, who somehow turned him over to the Americans. Now, I don't know all the details about why they turned him over to the Americans, except that he was, he was a Muslim. Maybe he was driving while Muslim or something. But and perhaps, because he was British, or perhaps, I really don't know why. He was turned over. Perhaps somebody just wanted to sell him to the Americans, because, back in those days, you think it was 2002, the Americans were paying top dollar for fresh meat for the whole train there from Bagram to Guantanamo Bay and everything. Anyway, so he's been in the gulag, the American gulag, since 2002. He was tortured in Bagram. He was renditioned to Morocco, I believe it was. I don't have all the details in front of me. Morocco, mm-hmm. Where he was tortured, sliced with knives, had his penis sliced with knives, body cut up. But eventually he ended up in the tender confines of Guantanamo Bay, where he's been for several years and is now on a hunger strike, although I just read today that they may be about to get to dump him off their hands and send him back to Britain. But anyway, there's a couple of lawsuits that have been brought on behalf of Binyam Mohammed. One of them in the United States is a lawsuit against, I think, a company called Jessup, I'm not sure, Jessup International, the company that was involved, a private contractor that was involved in renditioning him to Morocco.
Now, hold it right there, Chris. I want to see if I can try to make a connection for the audience. They might remember. We've, in fact, perhaps even during interviews with you, we've joked over the years about the case against Jose Padilla and how supposedly he was going to enrich uranium by swinging it in a bucket over his head. And that was taken as from, the way I read it and the sources, the way they originally reported it, it was basically, this guy's an idiot. And how could he be a threat? He was an absolute fool. But now we understand, now the truth comes out about where that story really came from, that Jose Padilla was going to make or wanted to make I don't know if it was supposed to be, a atom bomb or a hydrogen bomb or which, by enriching uranium, swinging it over his head.
Yeah, well, Binyam Mohammed was charged with the same thing originally. It all comes from, some satirical magazine article that was written a few years ago about, how to make an atom bomb. And it was, completely ludicrous. Now, I don't know, and finally they finally got to, I don't know about Padilla's case, but they got Binyam to admit, to confess that he had read this magazine article at some point, I mean, as you say, it's completely ludicrous. I mean, it's written in this style. I think it's actually written for the Nation magazine.
Well, I actually saw a thing on TV. I think Keith Olbermann was saying it started out as a Rolling Stone piece.
Rolling Stone, that's it.
It was a parody that went around in the early days of the internet that people thought was funny. And it has, something to do with the nitrous oxide in Whippets or something like that, whipped cream.
All sorts of stuff. And as you say,
Yeah, the whole thing was a complete joke. Not anything that anyone would take seriously at all, unless you're a torturer for a living.
That's right. Well, unless you want to have some kind of, you have to have some hoped up reason for it. So anyway, Muhammad, that's right. That's what Muhammad was in prison for. Well, first he was charged all his other plots, and they dropped everything else. And in the end, they dropped all charges. He's actually been held for 6 years now, going on 7 years now, for no reason at all. And as I say, he's about to get out. He's probably about to get out. Anyway, but the point was, as you're going to bring him back to Obama, there was a lawsuit. And yet now the tortures that Binyan Muhammad has undergone are pretty much in the public record, you know. They're in the public record. We know what he's gone through. We know what he's charged, you know, what he's alleging has happened to him. We have corroborating evidence from different places. All that's in the public domain. But the Bush administration has tried to quash the lawsuit, the American lawsuit, by saying that you know, because some of this information might be, it's not actually, might be sensitive intelligence, then they can't have the trial at all. They can't have no trial. State secret says you can't have this trial at all. And now, of course, that's a gross abuse of the State Secrets Act, which, you know, is draconian on its face anyway. But even, you know, you can say, because as some people have pointed out, you know, if you have a piece of evidence that is so hot, so much hot intelligence that it can't be said in open court, then you go to the judge, and he can rule with each individual piece of evidence. But no one has ever used the State Secret Act until Bush came along to throw out an entire case because something might be sensitive in it. So
and in America, as opposed to Great Britain, where you're on the phone from right now, there's no Official Secrets Act here. There is no state secrets privilege anywhere in the law in this country. It's simply made up by judges. And in fact, it came from a case where it turned out in the end, when the information finally came out, they were just lying. They weren't protecting secrets. They were protecting negligence.
Right, absolutely. Well, it's a state secret. It's not a State Secrets Act. It's a state secrets privilege that's been established in law, you know, just like the idea that corporations of people have been established by the courts. It's not a law. But anyway, the point of fact is that the Bush people, as you know, were trying to use this draconian interpretation. So then Obama's elected, and of course, you know, Obama's bringing hope and change and a change of underwear for everybody. I guess I don't know what he's bringing, but, you know, some kind of change. But this week they went back to court, and they took the exact same argument of Bush people saying, you know, this case cannot be held. The point is they're trying to quash this evidence of torture coming out. Now, at the same time they were doing that in America, they've also intervened in a British court because there's a British court case about Binyan Muhammad. He's a British resident. And these high court judges over here in Britain said they wanted to hear all this evidence. They said there's credible evidence of torture. This should proceed. But at the last minute, the UK government intervened with their own draconian laws over here to quash the case, saying, oh, no, it's a national security thing. And the judges revealed that what the national security problem that the British had was that both the Bush administration and the Obama administration told the Brits, that if they went through with this case, the United States would cut off all cooperation in terrorism cases. What they're trying to say was, you know, if we have any intelligence that you're about to be attacked by terrorists, we're not going to share it with you if you go through with this case and reveal this torture that we've been involved in.
And that's not just some pipsqueak nobody country. That's England, our most special relationship.
Our most specialist buddy, special relationship, you know, Anglo-American brotherhood and all this other claptrap. Yes, of course, that's our greatest ally in the war on terror. And they were threatening to just cut them off, you know, and say, oh, you know, somebody wants to blow you up, too bad.
Well,
and
you know,
all of this done by, you know, it's been done specifically by the Obama administration. Now, you know, it's just, you know, it would boggle the mind unless you already knew what Obama stood for. But it's quite amazing. Anyway, it's quite revealing, let's say. It's not really surprising, but it's quite revealing.
Mm-hmm. Well, a new block quote on your blog from, I forget which NGO did a report about what happened to this guy. And
yeah,
in the broad details and in some of the detailed details, I guess I should say the broad strokes and some of the details, you can tell, you know, we know what happened to this guy. It's the very worst things in the world, seems to me, the kinds of things where even if this guy really was a terrorist murderer, he's done his time now. Let him go. That, you know, this guy's been through absolute hell and back, all to accuse Jose Padilla of make-believe things.
Yes, it's all tied up to the Padilla case. You're right. And, of course, Padilla was subjected to horrible tortures, and he basically, as you know, he had his mind broken because when he finally got to court, he had no mind left. He was scared of his own defense lawyers. He couldn't cooperate with them. He'd been completely turned where he just was totally dependent on the on his tortures. You know, he was subjected to sensory deprivation and all sorts of tortures. He kept for years without any charges, kept in military brigs, all this sort of stuff. Which, by the way, the Padilla case, you know, Obama's getting getting a lot of snaps for supposedly beginning the process of one day closing down Guantanamo Bay, the concentration camp down there. But you know, well, okay, that's fine if they closed down Guantanamo Bay, but these same kind of tortures were being practiced in American prisons where Jose Padilla was being kept, and the American prisons in Bagram in Afghanistan, and the American prisons in Diego Garcia and, you know, in the Indian Ocean, where the British, where years ago the Brits moved out a whole people, the whole population, they dispossessed them because the Americans wanted to have a base down there in the Indian Ocean. And it's going on, you know, in Baghdad and all these other places like that. So, yes, great, even if they close Guantanamo Bay concentration camp, it doesn't stop any of this stuff from going on because it still goes on. It goes on right there, you know, in the good old homeland. So, but yeah, it all ties back to the Padilla case. And what we have seen is that the Obama people are following the Bush line, just straight down the line on this. And all this is to protect, not only to protect the people who have tortured, but I think it's to protect the power to torture. Because as you recall, just last week, Leon Panetta, who we were told was some great liberal was going to be in charge of the CIA, he testified under oath before God and everything to Congress that, oh, he would be sure, he would not hesitate to recommend to President Obama that he use harsh interrogation techniques that go beyond the Army field manual.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he even said, I would seek presidential authorization if it was a ticking time, which right there, what is he saying? It's not up to Congress. It's not up to the Constitution. It's up to the president to decide whether it's okay to torture somebody or not.
Well, this is the same, you know, theoretical position, whatever it is, you know, the same philosophy of governance that we had under the Bush administration. I mean, there's no difference in that.
And in fact, Chris, as you point out on your blog, he even uses the John Yoo, Alberto Gonzalez, Dick Cheney formulation, David Addington, Michael Haynes, George Bush formulation, that unless you torture someone to death, it ain't really torture.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is the whole, I mean, well, there's another court case where they are trying to uphold the John Yoo memos. I don't know all the details, and I wrote about that recently. But, yeah, I mean, this is why it's so... I mean, it would be funny if it wasn't so tragic, is that people, there's a sort of debate amongst the progressive, you know, side blogosphere. Well, gosh, what can we do? Do you think Obama should prosecute, you know, these people or these people? What, you know, they ain't going to prosecute nobody, you know, because they want the same powers. They're going to do the same powers. And they still retain most of this, all these, the same torturers actually still work for Obama now. They're Obama's torturers now. And I just want to make one more point I think is important, because we often hear about what the Obama people talk about is this Army field manual. He's going to restrict all interrogation to the Army field manual. Well, someone was pointing out the other day, I think it was on Alternet, I don't have it right in front of me, the techniques that the Army field manual allow are themselves torture. I mean, you know, they, especially if you use them in combination.
Well, and they altered it, right? I mean, this was the whole thing with the Detainee Treatment Act of John McCain, which, of course, still allowed the CIA to torture people but banned the military from doing anything outside the manual. Then they went and they updated the manual to allow torture in the military rules.
Well, I know what I find quite amusing in, you know, in a sort of bitter way, is you have so many of these progressives now, liberals, whatever you want to call them, you know, Obama supporters, who now look to the Army Field Manual is some Pentagon manual for harsh interrogation, and they treat it like it's, you know, oh, Obama's going to adhere to the manual, like it's the Constitution or something, like it's some sacred document. It's like you have all these formerly anti-war progressive types, and now here they are looking to a Pentagon manual for torture as their lodestone, you know, as their guiding star. It's just it's quite bizarre. And but anyway, I mean, you know, as many people said, and I think I probably said beforehand, what were you going to have under Obama presidency was that you were going to have the basic core principles of the Bush administration, and, you know, dressed up in better PR garb. And this is one of the, I think, you know, many people said this beforehand. I think I said this once or twice, and other people said back during the Bush days, is that you think Bush is bad. What's going to be bad is that someone's going to come along after Bush, and they're going to take all these powers, and they're not going to be a complete walking putz like Bush. And they're not going to look like some villain out of a science fiction movie like Cheney, you know. They're not, you know, because these people put people off, you know. They're going to be somebody that's going to be attractive. They're going to sound good. They're going to sound liberal. And they're going to use these same things. And they're going to be much more dangerous because people will go along with them. And Arthur Silver has made this point many, many times, is that why it is so dangerous when Obama does these things is that there's no opposition to it. Who's, you know, he's already sort of disarmed the so-called left or the so-called progressives or, you know. They say, well, we've got to back Obama, so who's going to stand up against these things? You know,
because the only other choice is the Republicans. They're the only opposition we got.
And they're not going to stand up against torture and war and things like that. So, you know, it's but, yeah, I mean, I wrote this, I think, recently, was that the Obama administration is going to uphold the core principles of the Bush administration, which is enriching the rich, as we've seen with this bailout, extending the empire, as we see with the, you know, extending the war on terror into Pakistan, and enhancing the authoritarian power of a militarized state, which is what they're doing with this, you know, Binyam Muhammad case and other things like that. So, yes, it's these. We live in interesting times, as they say. We certainly do.
Well, and, you know, what happened is, I don't know if, you know, to what degree there ever really was any, but there's been a complete breakdown in accountability. You know, you talk about, you know, how Obama's sworn to not look back at what happened in the last administration and any, you know, particular war crimes and torture statutes might have been broken and that kind of thing. And this is something that I learned as a kid, I think even back in the 1980s, was I learned about Richard Nixon that he had had an illegal secret war in Laos and Cambodia and that he'd been impeached for paying people hush money who'd participated in a burglary. And I thought, well, that's kind of strange. And then I watched Ronald Reagan get away scot-free with Iran-Contra, and everybody knew it was illegal. There was a law that said, no, you can't fund death squads in Nicaragua and El Salvador. It's right there in the rules, and they went ahead and did it anyway, and there's no accountability for that. Bill Clinton, of course, was impeached for lying in a civil deposition about a civil rights case, but he was the guy that burned Waco to the ground, who bombed Iraq for years and years, on average of once every 3 days, according to Jeremy Scahill. That's the conservative estimate. Actually, the New York Times says once every other day was the average, and that was all based on the lies. And it's just the same with all these guys. Of course, George Bush Sr. Pretended that he had satellite photos that said that the Iraqi army was about to barrel into Saudi Arabia, which was a lie. None of these people are ever impeached for actually torturing and murdering anybody. You got to get them on some technicality off the clock, you know?
Well, I mean, that's the way it always is with the really powerful. It's the Al Capone situation, right, you know? You can't get Capone for murder. You can't get him for burglary. You can't get him for extortion. But cheating on his income taxes, then you can get him. You see, that's how they got in, that's how they put Al Capone in prison.
Yeah, but now if you are Al Capone and evade your income taxes, they make you the head of the Treasury, the boss of the IRS.
Well, I tell you what, you know, I mean, seriously, we'd be a lot better off if Al Capone was the Secretary of the Treasury, you know, because at least one thing that Capone did was the Capone gang. They had a lot of social programs. They took care of that. In fact, I was reading the other day. You know where they have these date stamps on milk and food now, you know, used by such and such a time. It was the Capone people who made the milk companies in Chicago start doing that. The first people who ever did it, you know, because they're getting a lot of bad milk and they were getting, you know, their people, their territories. They're saying, you know, Al, we're getting bad milk, our feeling. So he went to the milk companies and said, you know, you got to put a stamp and tell people when this milk is good and when it's going to go bad.
That's funny.
Where all that comes from.
I thought you were going to say, you know, it might as well be Capone. That way just reveal what gangsters they really are. But
well,
no,
absolutely.
Because
yeah,
Capone was actually that much more caring than the state could ever be.
Well, I mean, in a lot of ways, yeah. I mean, if you're going to have gangsters, let's just have them out there in the open. And, you know, that's kind of the worst thing. But, you know, because I used to say this all the time, you know, one of the worst things about it is that, of course, you know, what the government actually does, you know, what Bush has done and what Obama's doing is bad in itself. But what's even somehow harder to take is that we're supposed to believe it's all noble, it's all good, it's all lawful. You know, I just always wanted to say that old saying, you know, don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining, okay? Just, you know, if you're going to piss on me, just say you're pissing on me, okay? Don't pretend like I'm supposed to like it or it's going to grow flowers or something, you know. That's like the hardest part. That's one of the things that got me started writing about all these things in the first place, politics back in the Bush thing, is that no one was sort of making that point. You know, we were all pretending like it was some sort of, you know, it was all legitimate somehow. I said, no, this is criminal. This is evil. This is criminal. This is stupid. But nobody was saying it at the time. And I just wanted to keep saying, you know, look, I know you're pissing down my back, and I'm just going to say you're pissing down my back. You know, I'm not going to let you call it, you know, raindrops from heaven or something. And that's, I mean, of course, what's really sad is that we have to do all that all over again. Now, here comes Obama, and we have to, you know, convince a whole other audience that this is what's happening. You know, if you enable torture, if you continue torture, if you keep George Bush's defense secretary in office, for God's sake, his Pentagon warlord in office, for the God's sake, you know, you're just continuing all this, you know. So it's not change. It's not wonderful. It's not new. It's just the same thing we've seen before.
Well,
and
you know,
in a slightly better package, you know.
I mean, that's really the thing, too, is, you know, just like with everything, it's all about the narrative and how to get out the narrative that this guy Obama is just some Democrat senator, so he looks a little bit different and he, you know, practices his speech in front of the mirror more times than some of the other guys or something. Big deal. It's not like he was Ron Paul or something who actually, you know, meant to change policy in 500 improved ways, you know what I mean? Like, for example, they had asked him and he swore that, you know, his first day in office, he would tell the Navy to get away from Iran, to get back from their coast would be the first thing he did. Now, that's change. You know, and everybody said, oh, screw that guy. You know, he's old. He's a Texas Republican. We don't like Texas Republicans. Give us the one word, one syllable slogan. Let us swoon for that. I don't want to, you know, learn about policy here.
Well, yeah, that's true. But of course, you know, the thing, if he'd run as a Democrat, they would have ignored him also, too. You know, they would have marginalized him. They would have found something, you know, something weird about him, like Kucinich or Mike Gravel and all those guys, you know, who ran. Mike Gravel was running. A lot of similar kind of situations as a Democrat. I mean, he was just sort of laughed off.
Right, yeah, and Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah, I mean, that's true, of course. I mean, you know, Ron Paul had all those strikes against him because of being Republican. He wasn't going to get a look in from progressives and stuff. Although some people I know, I just saw a guy the other night I saw later was Ron Paul supporter. Arlo Guthrie had come out for Ron Paul early on in the primaries, and he was here in Oxford recently for a good concert. So, I mean, you know, some people... You know, and you couldn't really accuse Arlo Guthrie of being some sort of right-wing conservative, now could you? No, I know, you're right, but I mean...
Well, and I don't mean to sell Kucinich short.
What you're saying is correct in that what Obama is you know, it's just the same. Well, I've written about this before, and other people have too. It's the same thing as Bill Clinton came in 1992. Oh, what a breath of fresh air. Oh, look at this young man. Oh, he must be such a liberal progressive. He's going to do away with the excesses of the Bush years, you know, all this kind of stuff. And, of course, he was, you know, the worst kind of corporate, well, whatever you want to call it, you know, corporate lackey sort of thing, just like Obama is, you know. I mean, Obama was the favorite candidate of Wall Street. He got more money from Wall Street than John McCain did. He got more money from the defense industries than John McCain did, you know. So
it really is a tale of salesmanship over substance. It's just because I didn't mean to leave out Kucinich and Gravel. You know, I'm sorry that I did. It's just obviously Ron is my favorite, but both of those guys were absolutely committed to peace, and both of them knew all the issues better. I remember Dennis Kucinich teaching Barack Obama that there's such a thing as the International Atomic Energy Agency and that they have a safeguards agreement with Iran, when Obama had no idea about this right there in the debate live on the stage.
Yeah, well, I know. I never heard anything about that. All I know is I'm going to nuke Iran if they stick at Israel, you know. So, yeah, I mean, well, absolutely. I mean, you had some people who were willing to say that, you know, Ron Paul's anti-empire stance was like you say, was, you know, practically unique. I haven't seen anything like this in 50 years in American politics. But it would have been marginalized in any case, I think. And I don't know. I don't know what the... I mean, I agree with you. The main point is that this whole narrative of Obama as, you know, a change agent and all this kind of stuff is you know, it just makes it even worse, makes the actual policies he does even worse because we're supposed to believe it's some kind of thing, something that's different.
And yeah,
different. I mean,
it makes me more ashamed of, you know, the population, too, because it's the economy, stupid. At least, you know, is multiple words and syllables going on there. It requires you to, you know, at least think about something for a minute or something. But hope and change, just two one-syllable, one-word slogans that mean absolutely nothing at all. And to think that you could actually buffalo such a giant percentage of the population into going for that, to me is... You know, it's like the Cola Wars or something. Like, can't you see through this or what? You know?
Yeah, well, I know you're absolutely right about that. But of course, you know, this is where Obama had great luck. He's coming along a place where people, you know, people want to yearn. There's a great yearning for change. You know, they want change. They've got to have change. They want change. It's just like, it's almost like when the Bolsheviks came in, you know, into the chaos after the revolution. Of course, they overthrew the real revolution with their slogan, you know, land, peace, and bread. Well, who didn't want, you know, here's the Russians that were, you know, they were devastated. They didn't know what's going on. They want land, peace, and bread. You say you're going to give them to them, that's what you'll go for, you know. But you're right. One thing was really unusual about Obama, I thought, because I'd read, of course, you know, I'm over here in Britain, so I don't see the news over there, thank God Almighty, you know, the TV news. And I don't even watch TV news over here. You know, so I didn't see the news and see all the clips. I just kept reading, you know, Obama's a great orator. He, you know, I've never seen such oratory, you know. I read all on the blogs, you know, these guys, you know, practically tearful about his great orator. I said, well, gosh, maybe he's a good orator, you know, whether you agreed with him or not. But a couple of times during the campaign, I got to see him actually give a speech. Just as you say, all he ever does is a string together the biggest, you know, a string of cliches. We need to hope. We got to work. We got to take responsibility. But I mean, they're just a bunch of string. They're just a string of cliches. I mean, I don't know where his reputation as a great orator comes from. You know, I mean, maybe it comes from the fact that he can write a book or something. But as far as his speaking goes, you know, speech making goes, it's just the most standard border plate that we've heard for 30 years. Actually, you know, Bush's speechwriters came up with some more juicy rhetoric, you know, for him to pass through his mouth. He didn't know what he was talking about, but it is quite amazing, the sort of sales job. But I think it does tie back to people's, you know, this is unfortunate. This is a sort of a tragedy. It ties back to people's great yearning for desperate yearning for, you know, real change. But, of course, all they were going to be allowed to be given was this sort of, you know, fake change agent. You know, they only give the choice between McCain and Obama. That was the only choice. You know, your choice is Kennedy and Nixon. Your choice is McCain, Obama. You know, your choice is, you know, Mondale or Reagan. I mean, you know, this is no choice at all. You don't get a choice.
Mm-hmm.
But because you have this genuine yearning, you know, it's almost like metal filings go to the magnet. You know, it's like, oh, that's change over there. That's what we want, you know. But, of course, that's not what we're going to get. We're going to get this horrible boondoggle of a bailout, you know. It continues and even exacerbates the Bush policies, you know. What are they going to give now? $1 million, $2 million, $3 trillion to these bankers, you know? I mean, it's just amazing.
Well, I guess it's somewhat sort of to our credit that the American people most of the time mean well. They just, they really don't have the ability to do anything about it, do they? I don't. What the hell am I going to do about it? And I care as much as anybody.
Well, I know. It's, well, I mean, people, I mean, American people mean well as much as anybody else in the world means well. I mean, you know, it's like, but, well, like I said, well, what we have here, well, yes, you're right. I mean, the point is we have such a gigantically powerful systems of power, you know, these systems of power, corporate power, state power, military power, all entwined with each other, financial power, all entwined with each other, and they're just massive. I mean, it's on a massive inhuman scale that it is very hard for anyone to move or to think, you know, how you can really change it. And so it is it's a dispiriting situation.
Mm. Well, you know, one thing that, because actually I'm like you, I never watched him on TV for a long, long time. I was introduced to the concept of Barack Obama by being told that he was a rock star and that he was just sweeping the nation and whatever back in, you know, I forget, 2005, I guess, early 2005 or something was the first time I ever heard of him. And of course, that just put me off from even wanting to know a thing about him for as long as possible. You know, I was no more impressed with all the, a rhythmic speech pattern or whatever than you were. But one thing that really showed me his character, you know, really drove it home, not that I hadn't already decided, but really drove it home, was in the presidential debate right there on the eve of his victory last November, and I guess it was the end of October when they had this debate, and they were talking foreign policy, he and John McCain and Tom Brokaw, and Somalia was brought up in the context of Black Hawk Down, and sometimes America tries to do good and feed the poor people, and we get chased out of there, and I forget if McCain was making the point that we should never ever leave a place that we occupy or else we look weak to terrorists, or exactly what the debate was, but Tom Brokaw, who's got to know better, I mean, he's Tom Brokaw. Come on, he's the number one hairdo on NBC, or at least was for so long. He's plugged in enough. He's got to know better. And clearly Barack Obama and John McCain know better. And I could, you know, using my imagination, I can see the gears turning in Obama's head as he's deciding, okay, we're leaving America's current war in Somalia out of this question. We're going to talk about Black Hawk Down, pretend that America has never had a thing to do with Somalia since then, and they went right along, all three of them. And yet, well, I don't know. Tell me, Chris, has America had any anything to do with intervening in Somalia at any time since 1993 or what?
Well, I think we sent some fruit baskets over there now and then and, you know, some baby formula. Well, no, of course, we've talked about here many times about you know, the horrific atrocity that America has helped commit in Somalia over the last 2 years, when they over 2 years now, when they got the Ethiopian army, the armies of the Ethiopian dictatorship, to invade Somalia, where they had their only stable government they'd had in about 15 years at that time, the Islamic Courts Union, as a collection of sectarian groups who had brought some stability to the country, not the kind of stability you and I would like to live under, but stability for people who'd lived, you know, in sheer hell for 15 years after the last American intervention. But as you know, what's happened since then during that regime change operation, where the Ethiopians came in and played the part of America in Iraq with American support, American air power bombing refugees, American, and this was like an escort. This is not some, you know, American death squads moving through Somalia to, you know, take out supposed terrorists and all this sort of thing. So now what's happened since that time? What's happened since that time? Well, I was just reading about this, you know, recently today. 10 to 20,000 people have been killed. 3.2 million people, oh no, 3.6 million people are now living on emergency food aid. They're about to starve. 1.3 million people have been driven out of their homes. 25% of the population is suffering from acute malnutrition. Now, before this happened, back in 2006, I just saw this statistic yesterday. There were 260,000 Somalis living on food aid, you know, because, you know, they're always having droughts and stuff there. They're living on food aid, you know, emergency food aid. 260,000. Now, after the American intervention, the American-led, American-backed, American-funded intervention, there, as I just said, there's 3.6 million people dependent on food aid to keep from starving. There's 10 to 20,000 people dead. The whole country's sort of ruined. And now what's happened? But what has happened? Well, recently, as you might know, you know, there's been the government that the Ethiopians and the Americans installed, this transitional federal government. The head of that government has been ousted. And who have they now put in place, who's now been elected by the Somali parliament, is the same man who was in head of the Islamic Courts Union when they drove him out. All this stuff is they went through all these 2 years of hell on earth and subjected these people to hell on earth to come all the way back to full circle and put back in power the same man that they drove out 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago. And of course now in the meantime, of course, what's happened is that because of the Ethiopian occupation, you know, America's help, more and more Somalis have been radicalized. And the more extreme element that was in the former Islamic Courts Union, you know, they've become more radical, they've become more virulent, and now there's a sort of internal war. Now they're fighting against their former allies. And so what we're going to have now in Somalia probably is, unless by some miracle the new president, whose name is Sheikh Sharif, who is a quasi-moderate, you know, Islamic cleric, I mean, unless he somehow can bring together the more extreme Islamic elements that are still fighting, we're going to have, you know, a good old long-range, long-lasting civil war in Somalia. So, all this hell on earth has been unleashed. And as you said, this is, you know, and I've mentioned this over and over and over again during the campaign, not one syllable about what's happened in Somalia these last 2 years, what was even happening on the ground all during this summer and all during the campaign, not one syllable escaped the lips of any of those presidential candidates, of McCain or Barack Obama, who is, as we know, of African descent, and has family living in Kenya next to Somalia. And, not a single word was said about what's going on in Somalia, not a word. And as you said, there they were on the podium, on the debate floor, talking about Somalia, but talking about Black Hawk Down. Well, because there was a movie made about Black Hawk Down years ago, which, you know, and of course that movie, as we know what happened in the Black Hawk Down, was a bunch of Americans got massacred after the Americans had gone in and massacred a whole bunch of Somalis beforehand. And that's why they were attacked, and that's why Americans were dragged to the streets of Mogadishu and things like that. And in any case, one of the people that the Bush administration had later on backed, you know, one of the warlords they backed against the Islamic Courts Union in their regime change operation, is the son of the man who killed the Americans the first time around. So, you know.
Right, yeah, Adid. So, Adid, yeah. The bad guy.
Yeah, Adid and, yeah, that's right.
You know, I saw an episode of Frontline long ago where they interviewed the father of one of the dead Army Rangers. Or, I don't know, he might have been a Delta guy, I don't know which. Yeah. Anyway, the father said he met Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm trying to paraphrase best I can. So I says to Bill Clinton, hey, listen, let me ask you something. You guys were trying to negotiate with this guy, Adid, and you had had your Secretary of State, I forget who it was at the time, Warren Christopher, whoever, send, you know, one of his munchkins to go and try to work out a deal with this Adid guy. And Bill Clinton said, yeah, that's right. And then I said, well, then why did you send my son out to go and kidnap the guy at the same time you're trying to make a negotiation with him? And then he said, Bill Clinton gave me the most blank look I've ever seen on a man's face. He just stared at me, and then he said, well, I don't know. I asked Tony Lake the same question.
God almighty.
And, in fact, I one time found that transcript online and was able to get the Google cache. I don't know if anybody can find it anymore, but it's out there somewhere. And so, yeah, it is just from one travesty to another. But, yeah, I mean, here's the thing about it. Even if Obama cared about Somalia, which I don't see any reason to believe that he cares at all about what George Bush and Dick Cheney and the Ethiopian army have done to that place. But even if he did care, he couldn't mention it without having to teach everyone the entire story, because no one in America has ever heard of it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a very good point. I mean, this is one of the problems I've had, you know, because, you know, I've been writing about Somalia a lot. I mean, I'm not an expert by any means, but there's a lot of people out there who knows much more about it than I draw.
No, you're unique just because you care and have a voice on the subject.
But one of the problems, yes, that's one of the problems, is that you have to sort of, every time I write about it, I feel like I have to spend about four paragraphs to explain what I'm writing about, because no one knows, has ever heard of it. No one knows anything about it. It's funny you mentioned that thing about Clinton saying, well, gosh, yeah, I asked Tony Lake how that happened. It reminded me of something when someone asked Bush later on about why they dissolved the Iraqi army, you know, right after the invasion, which helped instigate the insurgency, you know, and helped bring ruin to the Iraqi society. And Bush said, yeah, I don't know how that happened. I'm going to ask somebody about that. It's, you know, this is the commander-in-chief that we're all supposed to follow and stuff like that, you know. But
well,
anyway,
you know, that guy, Thomas Ricks, who's basically the new trumpet for Odierno and Petraeus and their push to stay forever, he last night on The Daily Show explained that Petraeus never told George Bush about the program to rename the insurgency to concern local citizens and put them on the payroll.
Yeah.
That very same insurgency that they had created with the firing of the army, that they didn't tell. And he said he asked Petraeus, you didn't tell Bush until later or what? And Petraeus just said, yeah, that's within my realm of authority, whatever, to straight up hire the evildoers, the evil terrorists who 4,000 of our guys died fighting for years in a row.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of thing that the president's not even apparently concerned with. People under him know better than to even bother him with such details.
Well, that's above the president's pay grade, I guess. But, I've been reading about this, about Ricks and I can't even say without saying Petraeus. Of course, Petraeus is obviously angling for the presidency himself, and maybe, you know, in 2012, 2016, we'll finally have this perfect, you know, perfect meshing of our militarist state, you know, when the general finally just takes over or something. But, it's quite a story.
Yeah. Well, then I guess the real question is, then after somebody stabs Petraeus in the back, then who's the dictator, you know?
No, well, that's true. I mean, yeah, but...
Et tu, Pelosi?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Boy, can you imagine her as the emperor? Boy.
Yeah, I mean, we're really blessed with a great generation of leaders all the way around. Wouldn't you say about that? I mean, we live in a golden age, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what, I certainly am glad that that you keep writing. It's great to see somebody whose eyes are so clear and is also so talented with the prose, can keep me entertained and. I read this horrible stuff, and I want to thank you very much for your time again on the show, Chris.
Well, thank you. Thanks a whole lot.
All right, everybody, that's Chris Floyd. The book and the blog are called Empire Burlesque, High Crimes and Low Comedy in the American Imperium Now. That's at chris-floyd.com. That's it for Anti-War Radio. See y'all tomorrow, 11 to 1, Los Angeles time.